Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. I'm also the youngest elder here, I think. Well, at any rate, happy Sabbath to everyone. I'm glad to see you. Thank you for coming out and being with us and sharing God's Sabbath with us today. Before anybody starts, too many people asking me about what's wrong with my face, I'll just admit that every 3 or 4 years I take this feeble attempt at growing facial hair. So it's in the works about a week right now, and it usually lasts about 2 weeks because I miss the cool of the pillow against my cheek more than anything, other than it doesn't come in very well. So between the two of those things, if you want to pray about that one way or the other, that's up to you. But so at any rate, we're playing that game again, and just do that every once in a while. As Mr. Gardenhire was mentioning, next Friday evening on April the 3rd, we'll be observing the what has become or come to be called in the our church speak as a night to be much observed. And then, of course, that comes from the King James Version of the Bible. The New King James calls it a night of solemn observance to the Lord. Other variations are night to be remembered, and you can look in a different varieties of translations. But I ask you, why will we do that? Why will we meet to keep the night to be much observed? I mean, it's not a commanded assembly. You can look through Leviticus 23 all the way through it, and you won't find a command there to assemble and to do that. And it's not even mentioned in the New Testament. And yet we're going to do that. Is it because of tradition? Well, partly. Is it to celebrate Israel's deliverance from Egypt? Well, that's a little harder, but a little bit probably, partly, because we look back on the deliverance in God's act to deliver Israel from Egyptian bondage. But what I would like to talk to you about today is to tell you why I keep the night to be much observed and why I believe that all Christians should. Let's begin where the special night originated in Scripture in Exodus 12. We find in the King James Version, Exodus 12, verses 41 and 42. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all of the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be much observed unto the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. Now, perhaps some of us might even be physical Israelites, and some might be physical Jews. But we are all, if we are converted and have the Holy Spirit and part of God's family, we are spiritual Israel. And so we should be looking at not just the physical aspects of the past and what took place there, but to be looking forward. The same two verses, actually I want to read verses 40 through 42 in the New King James Version. We came up with that, I should back up and say we came up with that title, and it has been predominant, Night to be Much Observed, when the King James Version was the dominant version of the Bible that we used in the church. Now that the New King James seems to have pretty much overtaken that, we still hold on by tradition to what we know and what we've called Night to be Observed rather than a night of solemn assembly or observance. Anyway, Exodus 12, verses 40 through 42 in the New King James says, "Now the sojourner of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Now, that doesn't mean just the soldiers and the warriors went out. The word actually means the masses. And so the whole people were delivered by the Lord and went out from Egypt. Verse 42, "It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations." Now you'll recall that, as I read here a couple of times, that the children of Israel had been in Egypt for 430 years. And you no doubt remember how that came about. There was Joseph was prime minister of Egypt, and had been overseeing the securing of foodstuffs to supply from that 7 years of bounty to prepare for the 7 years of famine that would follow it. And that famine reached far and wide throughout the Middle East in that period. And Israel and his family, not knowing that Joseph, their son, was his son was still alive, sent brothers down to Egypt to find out if there was food available that they could purchase to take back. And I'm sure you're familiar with the story. One of the sons was kept there as kind of collateral that they would come back and bring Israel down with them. And so they settled there. And Joseph gave them the land of Goshen. And the Pharaoh agreed to that. The land of Goshen was a very productive area of Egypt. And it was premium real estate, let's say, because the crops would grow there very well, and they could live at peace, and they lived away from the Egyptians because the Egyptians didn't like shepherds and didn't think much of sheep and that sort of thing. And so the Israelites settled there and lived quite peaceably and grew and grew until their numbers approached a couple of million or so, as we speculate by the number that in other places are talked about how they came out of Egypt. But what happened in the first chapter of Exodus, something happened that changed that their situation. Chapter 1 and verse 8 of Exodus. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So this is several generations down the line, but Joseph, even as great as he had been relegated to the past and was no longer appreciated for what he had done, nor his people, given the privileges that they had had. And so he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. So they had grown into a very powerful, by numbers, a lot of people. And come and let us deal wisely with them, and lest they multiply and it happen in the event of a war that they join with our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land. Now, it's amazing that these people had lived so peaceably together for so long, but this illustrates what happens at the times of change of governments. And in particular, when you're talking about dictators or kings or pharaohs who can do virtually anything they want at any time they want to do it. And they can change things. And so he probably was jealous of the fact that the land of Goshen was producing so well for these people, and that it probably was costing him in slave labor, the upkeep of other slaves to take care of the business of the nation in so far as the menial labor and so forth. And so he looked on this as an opportune time to grab a group of people and put them to work, put them to hard work. Egypt, in Exodus 1, verses 13 and 14, says, so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. Rigor. That's a tough word. It means it too. It means tough going with imposing upon them very, very harshly. And harshness could be another word for rigor there. But they made the Israel serve them with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All of their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Beyond that and a few other scriptures here and there, the Bible really is pretty silent on what degree of bondage the Israelites were in. And I can't guess with you, but I would speculate just a little bit that it probably, from what we read, was not as bad of bondage and slavery, as an example, that American slavery was through the 18th or 17th and 18th centuries of the United States, where families were just torn apart and the brutal aspects of American slavery. We don't see that. We see they're working with rigor and they're hard pressed. And so forth, and no doubt the slave masters or the taskmasters beat them when they and whipped them and so forth when they weren't producing as fast as they thought that they should. But the degree to which they were enslaved or in bondage isn't really very clear, and I'm not sure how well we can actually relate to that. I spoke a few years back, quite a few years back now, and compared it the slavery to sin to more like American slavery. And I think that sin is closer to that than what we read into the story here of the Israelites in Egypt. But nevertheless, there's a little other more indication in Exodus 6. Exodus 6, verses 5 through 7. I'm going to read from the New Century Version on this one. He says, "Now I have heard the cries of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are treating as slaves." I use this translation because it says slaves. You know, I did a word search this morning on the words slave, slaves, slavery. Yeah, you got it, slavery. That's what I'm trying to say. And came up with one instance in the Old Testament. Bondage, on the other hand, comes up many, many times. And they're related, but I was surprised. I thought, you know, I've read lots of scriptures that talk about being the Egyptian slavery and so forth. And it's kind of what we just talk about and the way that we express it that has led me to believe that. But nevertheless, I found one other translation that did use that word, and that's the one I'm reading right now. "Now I've heard," this is Exodus 6, 5 and 7, again from the New Century Version. "Now I've heard the cries of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are treating as slaves. And I remember my agreement. So tell the people of Israel that I say to them, I am the Lord. I will save you from the hard work the Egyptians force you to do. I will make you free so you will not be slaves to the Egyptians. I will free you by my great power, and I will punish the Egyptians terribly." You know, as Moses came to the children of Israel to deliver them, as God's messenger and leader to do that, you know that things went from bad to worse, to worse, to worse, about 10 times, because you go through the plagues and the reactions that Pharaoh had and the punishment that was dealt out to the Israelites. And they were close to collapse by the time they got to the point where the Passover angel came and the firstborn were killed and slain in Egypt, and the people delivered. But when they were delivered, they were taking that next step that I've mentioned before, and I'm going to repeat again. When things go from bad to worse, they either done that next step, they go to disaster or to miracle and blessing. And that's what happened with with the Israelites as they escaped from Egypt. They were able to leave Egypt, started out pretty good. They had been in this bondage for 400, they'd been there for 400 years. They hadn't been in bondage for that long. But they had been in bondage for long enough that they needed to, were happy to get away because things were bad. But it got worse, and then it got better because they got away. It looked like they were free. And then Pharaoh's army began to chase them. Uh-oh, here comes another version of worse. And the chariots of Pharaoh and his soldiers just charged hard to try and catch up with the Israelites. And they were backed up against the Red Sea in the back and mountains on the other sides, and they were trapped. And many were thinking, okay, we've been from bad to worse. This is going to be disastrous. But that wasn't what God had in mind. He had a miracle in mind, and he parted the Red Sea so that they were able to pass through. And then as the Egyptians entered into the sea, the walls of the water collapsed and drowned them all and delivered Israel from Egypt. Now today, without meaning to make light of their condition, and I don't mean to make light of their condition, I'd like to share a bit of my story of deliverance from bondage. And I do that because I want you to understand the reason that I celebrate the night to be much observed in light of Jesus' sacrifice for my sins, and why I think each of us should have something more close to us to relate to, that so that we will feel the empathy and know what has been done for us and why we should be celebrating on that particular evening. I think and I hope that you will better relate to the idea of bondage, and along the way you'll probably learn something more about me that you don't know. Some of which some of you have heard, a little some of it you probably won't have. But let's go to my story, and it's not the only story. Each of you could tell a story as well. But I was thinking about this idea of bondage and how to make it more relatable and a night to be much observed. And the time that I remember thinking back, besides when God called me and was baptized and what a celebration that was, it was the day I got out of the Navy. That was a day to be much observed. And that night we had steak on the grill and then just ate and had a great time because my indentured servitude and bondage to the U.S. Navy was over after 4 years. How many of you are veterans or mates of veterans? And there's enough of you to realize and to know what I'm talking about today, that while it's not slavery, there's always somebody who can tell you what to do and when to do it, and you better do it. And there are rules, regulations, and discipline, everything that goes along with being a part of a military organization. So my story here will begin in November of 1967, and I got a draft notice. This was just a few months before the draft changed to a lottery where I might have gotten lucky and my number not come up, but nevertheless it did, and I had to go to St. Louis to take a physical with the idea that in January I would be drafted and I'd probably be going into either the Army or the Marine Corps. And this is, of course, if you've forgotten, the heart of the Vietnam War going on all this time. I remember very clearly my friends and I, when we were in high school and the war was just getting started in the early 60s, and we said, that'll be over long before we get old enough to have to go over there and be a part of that. And it didn't. It just drug on and on and on. And so by my time, I decided that, the war was not a place I wanted to be. I didn't want to have to go into the military. I didn't want to go to Vietnam, and I didn't want to get hurt. And I went to Vietnam, and I got hurt. Good to bad to worse to actually miracle, as we'll see. But instead of being drafted, I joined the Navy. I went to St. Louis and scoured around, talked to people, found somebody, a recruiter that had an open billet for guaranteed to go into the Seabees, into the construction battalion. So that's what I went for. And I signed up for 4 years. I got a 120-day delay program. I didn't have to go for 6 more months. I thought, anything that pushed that date out just a little bit farther, maybe there'll be peace. Maybe we'll stop this crazy thing. But nevertheless, it didn't. And so I joined and ended up in Great Lakes Naval Training Center. That's just north of Chicago in March of 1968. And it was cold. It was cold. When you're out on the parade grounds at 5 o'clock in the morning and snow up to your knees all the way around that has been cleaned off so that you can march and do exercise, you know, it was pretty tough. There's a discipline in it. And for those of you who haven't experienced it, I don't know that I can share it with you enough, but just to know that somebody is always telling you to do something and you better do it. And there was little leeway and little liberty involved with that. And during the course of the 13 weeks or so of boot camp, there's one week in particular that's typically known as Hell Week, and it's where you are working very, 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 very long hours and exercising all day long and getting maybe 3 or 4 hours of sleep. And that feels like bondage. That feels like bondage. Well, I got out of boot camp and married Jackie. Things went from better to better and good. She's looking at me like she's, I'm not sure. She doesn't know what I'm going to talk about. Well, we got married right out of boot camp, and she was right out of high school. So we were 19 and 17 when we got married. I was about a month and a half from being 20, and she was a couple months from being 18. And that's 46 years later. So here we are. We've made it, delivered out of the bondage that the first few years of our marriage were because of me, not because of Jackie, but because of me. And we went from Southern Illinois, little towns. You know, her town was 800 people at the time. I was from the big town next door, 2,700 people. We were a little bigger town. The big town actually was 10,000 people that lived, you know, I mean, about 10 miles away. But we had the bigger town, and so we went from that to California, because that's where I went to what they called A school, where that's, they teach you how to do something that, that will be helpful for the time that you're going to serve. And so I was designated as a heavy equipment operator, and we moved to Port Hueneme, just north of Oxnard, and were there for about 4 or 5 months getting training and having four-section duty, which for those of you who don't know, it means every fourth day you're staying on that base all day long and you've got watches any time that you're not doing training and so forth. So it can be kind of tough. We were out there. Jackie, the first time she'd ever flown on an airplane, flew to Los Angeles and then flew up to Oxnard. I was at the airport waiting to meet her, and her bags came in and she didn't. We're not this time of, not a time of cell phones or anything like that, so I couldn't call, and I was desperately trying to find out if she was going to be on the next plane, and somebody at the airport there helped me and found out that yes, she indeed was on the next plane, so that was good, and we got her picked up and went to the little place that we rented to stay at. The big surprise, one of the big surprises about being in the Navy or any military organization, especially back then, the pay was very low. Almost like bondage. I mean, I had been making in 1967, 66, 67, I was averaging about $250 a week, which was a lot of money. Now, I was working 60 hours a week in natural gas pipeline construction, putting the natural gas pipeline across Missouri and Iowa, but Nevertheless, I was used to having money. First paycheck I get when I'm in the Navy is for $12 for 2 weeks. The second 2 weeks, I got $14. So I had $26 a month, plus Jackie, some of my money went to her because they had an allotment. I think you got 104, as I recall. She got 104, and I'm sitting there at 26. So between us, we got $130 a month to live on. Now, that's maybe not be slavery, but it's not getting a lot for what you're putting in. Not a lot. So we finally survived that, and then we're transferred to NAS, Naval Air, Auxiliary Air Station in Meridian, Mississippi. Meridian, Mississippi. For 13 months, we lived in Mississippi. Started out with not much more pay, just a little bit. I got a little bit when we left A school, got a little promotion, one step. It wasn't a lot. Jackie supplemented by working in the golf concession stand, serving frying and serving catfish and hush puppies. Helping out in any way she could, and she was very good about that. But they were difficult months for us, and we had rather poor housing conditions, and of course I was dissatisfied with the conditions of not having any money, and being young and immature, I didn't make things the easiest for Jackie, and yet she has always made the best of everything. It wasn't long when we were there that I was pretty good at what I was doing, and so I got a promotion to third class petty officer quickly. Made a little more money, and was on in line to get a quick promotion to second-class equipment operator. They had a recommendation from the chief to speed up and to give me a pass on not having to wait a whole year to do that. Unfortunately, I began to drink way too much and too often, and trouble came my way. And so about after 9 months in Mississippi, when I was on the verge of that other promotion, instead, I went before a captain's mast, which is just short of, a court-martial. But it wasn't that bad. But nevertheless, the captain and I got to know one another, and he decided it would be best if I didn't have third-class petty officer rank, and he busted me down one grade, reduced me in rank, which really made me happy. And so I was stuck once again. With things going from bad to worse. And on top of that, drinking increased a lot, and a lot of times I was drunk or hungover. I wrecked our car. I rolled a 61 Oldsmobile into a little wad that looked like a Volkswagen, totally destroyed it, got away, got thrown out of the car, and had barely a scratch on me. God was beginning and had been for some time working with me. But I'm pretty hard-headed. And there's a particular night that I remember, and I hope I'll never forget this. And whether it was true, whether I dreamed it, whether it was hallucination, I can't tell you. I'm like Paul when he's talking about the guy who went to the third heaven. I don't know if this is true. I don't know. But the message was true. We had in our bedroom a little open gas heater for the in the little house that we rented. And it had open flame that heated the house. Now, how that passed any kind of safety regulations, I don't know. But that's what we had. And I woke up in the middle of the night one night and looked over at that little fire heater, and sitting on top of it was what I think is nothing less than a little demon. And he was looking at me and laughing. He said, "You're mine." I've got you. You belong to me. I'm sure I cursed and said something that shouldn't have, probably. Then it went away. Now, you'd think that a situation like that would change one. Like I said, I was hard-headed. I didn't quite get it yet. And I was slow to learn that God was trying to save me. So in January of 69, I went to Vietnam. Was there for just about a month and got hurt in an explosion, not military, not combat related, but the pain hurt just as bad. There was a fire at our asphalt plant, and I went out and put it out with a dozer, pushing dirt over it. And once the one pass in, I had it all out, but about a 10 or 15 foot diameter circle, and there was an explosion right in front of the dozer, and I got flash burns and heat burns, second degree burns all over my face and both hands, and that time God got my attention. That was about the third time that I survived something that should have taken my life. And while I had been supplementing my Navy income with playing poker and other sorts of gambling, I figured my odds were getting pretty slim to keep surviving these kind of things. And so I started to pay attention. And it was then that God finally did get my attention. So it was from bad to worse to good. To good. I spent 6 months between hospital and some temporary duty until new skin grew back and everything was treated. Didn't have to have surgeries or plastic surgeries or grafting or anything like that. All they did was just rip off the burnt skin with suture removers and then put some white cream on it that was about three times hotter than fire ever was. And I said, "Yes, Lord, I got it. I got it. I believe it." 15 months I spent after that in Okinawa and became more receptive, began studying the Bible, and began to be a changed man. Not because of me, but because of God working through me and working in me. I had been on that island for nearly 15 months, and Jackie and I had been together about 30 days out of 20 or 24 months with all the moving around and the different duty stations that I was at, and Vietnam and Japan and Tennessee until I got to Okinawa. And we just couldn't afford to bring her to Okinawa, so she stayed at home with her folks. And at about a year or close to that 15-month mark, I still had 9 months to go, and their plans were to leave me there for that length of time. And I decided I got to do something to get off this rock. So what you have in the military service, at least at the time, is what's called a detailer. And my detailer was in Washington, D.C. He's the one that would make the decision of who went to what station, what gap needed to be filled here or there. And, of course, this is not a time when we had open phones where you could just pick up and for virtually nothing talk to half the world. It was like $25 a minute on a regular phone and couldn't do that. We had Armed Forces radio or telephone where you could call in. And the only problem was you had to put in what level of emergency, or what, not emergency, but level of priority of call that you were making. And when I talked with my the executive officer, he said, "Go in and use the lowest level of priority to make your phone call." Well, that meant getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to get to my detailer in Washington, D.C. And the problem with this prioritized mailing, or excuse me, a phone system, is that if a higher priority call comes in, it just cuts you off. No bye, no nothing, just you got dead space. Hello, 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 nothing. Two nights that happened to me. I was getting my story, pitching my story to the detailer, trying to get him to get me off that island and get me somewhere back in the United States where I could be with my wife again. Kept getting cut off. The third night, I decided, you know, sometimes it's better to do something and ask for forgiveness later than permission. I called on National Priority 1, life and death, or national emergency priority. I got through to my detailer. I talked to him as long as I wanted. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I've got an opening in San Diego at Coronado, but it's just a temporary deal. And if you take that position there, I want you to promise me that you're not going to reenlist and stay there. And I said, you have no problem. Don't worry about that. You just get me off this rock and get me there. I will not be re-upping, re-enlisting. I'm not kidding you one bit. So my orders came through. I was able to do that. Jackie and I moved to California and San Diego, and I was at Coronado for the last 9 or 10 months that I was in the service. And so in June of 1972, I became a free man again. My tour was over. My enlistment was up. I still had supposedly 2 years of non-active duty that we were supposed to report to, I don't know, some naval center, and I don't know where you were, and I just never got around to that. Figured if they needed me bad enough, they'd come and find me, and I wouldn't make it easy for them because I didn't want them to go back to any part of being on active duty. At 2 years in, you get this thing, you know, because that's the length of the draft was 2 years. And when you're signing for 4 years thinking you're avoiding those 2 years of being a grunt in Vietnam, it sounds pretty good. When you get to two and a half years and you still got a year and a half or so to go, you begin to wonder, should I have made a different decision? But I think I made the right decision in the long run, and God worked with it and brought us to this point. We started attending church in June of 1973. We were baptized in November of that year, and the rest is kind of history. History that some of you don't know, and some of you will. Perhaps I'll be able to share some with you later on. But I hope that you, as I explain this, and I'm not doing it to promote myself, but to hopefully give you something that you can relate to, in a sense of the bondage, not nearly as bad as the Israelites had, and not nearly as bad as the bondage that we have, the sin, when sin owns us, and when not just that little demon, but that big dragon is the one that says, I've got you, you're mine, and I'm not letting go of you. There's similarities. We don't want to, I got that call to come to California, Jackie was elated. Elated. She wanted to come back to California so bad. I think it was her prayers that got it. I didn't care about coming back to California because I didn't enjoy the time that I spent up in Oxnard. It just wasn't, it wasn't San Diego, believe me, by a long shot. But the idea of being set free or getting off of Okinawa, as an example, and coming to San Diego is kind of like getting released from the burden and the bondage of sin. Because I got here, and the only thing I had to do was just promise that I wasn't going to re-up. That's what we got to do. When our sins are forgiven, we make the promise that in a covenant with God, we're not going to give up and re-enlist. I know each of you have similar stories, I'm sure. Maybe not exactly, of course, but idea things that have happened to you and that you can draw on to be more aware of why there is a night to be much observed that I enjoy and celebrate, and I hope that you do too. Because that New Testament night to be observed is significant to Christians because it's a collective celebration of our personal deliverance from sin through the blood of our Passover sacrifice. And each year, Passover should remind us of the great sacrifice that was required to deliver us from the bondage of sin. And we should celebrate that deliverance with fellow Christians on a special night, a special evening that we call the night to be much observed. I hope you have a wonderful one and celebrate it very greatly.